This is tape number 4 of the Home Temple Diaconate Studies in Old Testament Literature and History. We are reading through the first book of Enoch, which probably dates from the very early 2nd century before the Christian era. Enoch is in the presence of God, and God is sending him to take a message back to the fallen angels. And he says, "Have no fear, Enoch, good man and scribe of goodness. Come hear my voice. Go speak to the watchers of heaven who have sent you to intercede for them." So Enoch has been brought up in vision against his own will. Because he was such a good man, he was able to, pure enough to actually ascend to heaven. They've literally taken him up to heaven. They're the ones that are in charge of the winds and all the elements and the sublunar spheres of the world, as opposed to the outer spheres, which are ruled by the good angels. But these have fallen into the earthly spheres below the moon and so on. And they have sent you to intercede for them. Tell them you should intercede for men and not men for you. Tell the angels they should be interceding for men. Why do you leave? Why did you leave lofty, holy heaven to sleep with women, to defile yourselves with the daughters of men and take them as your wives, and like the children of the earth to beget sons, in your case, giants? These were the Nephilim. Though you were holy and spiritual, living the eternal life, you defiled yourself with the blood of women. You begot children with the blood of flesh, and like the others, you have lusted after flesh and blood, as do those who die and perish. This is the idea that you will find in Buddhism, which is you die or you stay in the eternal rounds of incarnation and the cycle of incarnation by remaining affixed upon the things below and following the lower impulses that lead you away from heaven, away from the unity, away from the forces of the motion to the right, as Plato would say, or the good Yetzer, which leads you towards unity, diversity, and heaven, and leads you up and out of this world. This is what the early form of Buddhism was about. Theravada Buddhism was to finally end your ceaseless rounds of incarnation and to be able to rise and ascend out of the earth and leave it behind and go into a higher, better state. Mahayana Buddhism, introducing the idea of the bodhisattva, was the idea of the saint that, even though had earned the right to do this, stayed and remained until every sentient being had achieved liberation. Well, this message, whether we're talking about liberation or salvation or redemption, it's all the same message, and it's the same message being given in the East as in the West. And here is God speaking, "But you, the angels, the fallen angels, were spiritual and immortal for all generations of the world, so I gave you no wives, for heaven is your proper dwelling place," because the angels are properly androgynous. They have no need of wives or of husbands, and they're not considered to be male, although they're emanations of Godhead, which is again not considered to be male at this stage. "And now the giants, offspring of spirit and flesh, will be called spirits on the earth, and the earth shall be their dwelling. Their bodies emitted evil spirits because they were born from human women and the holy watchers. The giants afflict, oppress, destroy, attack over the earth. Though they hunger and thirst, they do not eat. They offend. These spirits will rise up against men and women because they proceed from them. The giants will slaughter unpunished until the day of the great judgment. Then the age, the watchers, and the godless will be wholly consummated. As for the watcher who sent you to intercede for them, tell them you were in heaven, but the mysteries were not revealed to you. You knew worthless ones, and in the hardness of your hearts you revealed these to women, and through these secrets women and men work much evil." He's talking about the secrets of magic, sorcery, etc., which are revealed by the angels, etc. Now, in another part of this apocalypse, Enoch journeys through Sheol. Sheol is the underworld. When in the older Hebrew, before there was a real concept of heaven and saints and things, Sheol was where everybody went. When you died, you went to the place of the shades, Sheol. It was the underworld. It was a place that wasn't very nice to be. It was just a place where you were dead. You were a shadow. It was like the old concept of Hades among the Greeks. After people died, they just became shades or shadows or memories. They couldn't eat or drink. They couldn't enjoy. They were just ghosts. And very, very few heroes would be translated to become semi-divine. They would become demigods, and they would go to the Elysium, the fields of Elysium. And then in the mystery cults and the mystery religions, the salvation after death, to live eternally, to be awake and conscious, the idea of resurrection, which appears in the teachings of Jesus, is not something that happens physically at a later time in life, but it happens after every person's death. Those who have achieved spiritually achieve the tikkun, the resurrection, which means to be awake, continuity of consciousness after death. And those that are worthy to achieve it no longer are have to be born. They are now spiritual beings who live as they do in the Hermetic Brotherhood, in the Ogdoad, in the Eighth Heaven, and they can assist human beings, and there are spirits who can assist and augment other human beings. Same was the tradition in Judaism. But here, we're going in a transition from the old concept of afterlife, which is in Sheol, which is in just the place of shades, to the afterlife, which is you may have a choice. You either go to Sheol, or you can go into the higher heavens. And it's the same thing in the Greek mysteries. Now, here his vision of Sheol is that it is at the end of the earth. It's the beginnings of the idea of hell. Not a hell where everybody's tormented in lakes of fiery pus, as the Catholic Church develops about the AD, the 4th or 5th century. But here is the idea of Sheol. They brought me to a place in which people were like flaming fire when they wished. They appeared as men, and then they brought me to the place of darkness, into a mountain whose summit reached to heaven. And I saw the places of the luminaries, the treasuries of the stars and the thunder, and in the uttermost depths a fiery bow, arrows, their quiver, a fiery sword. And it goes to all these places. And finally, he comes to this place where there's no water, and there's no birds, and there's a horrible wasteland. And he's told by an angel that this place is the end of heaven and earth. It has become a prison for the stars and the host of heaven. And the stars which roll over the fire have transgressed the Lord's commandment in the beginning of their rising, for they did not appear at their appointed times. And God was angry with them and bound them for 10,000 years until their guilt was appeased. And the archangel Uriel said to me, Uriel is Ariel, Uriel is Oriel, which means the angels' names, something El, means the something of God. They're the emanated powers of God, and the Uriel is the light of God. It also appears as A-U-R-I-E-L, Oriel. And he said, here shall stand the angels who have been attached to women. Their spirits, assuming many different forms, are defiling mankind and will lead them astray into sacrificing to demons as gods. And here they shall stand till the day of the winds of heaven, which turn and bring the circumference of the sun, etc., etc. Now, this is the idea that there are two concepts of why mankind suffers. One concept is the idea of genetic sin, which is the sin of Adam and Eve, and that concept is no longer operative in this view, because the Deuteronomic ideas of sin have been changed by the prophets and other people and by the disputations of the book of Job, etc. No, there are other kinds of evil that come upon human beings that are karmic evil. And this is evil that was brought about by a rebellion in heaven when the evil angels fell upon the earth. And it is they who bring these problems, and they delude mankind. It's sort of the idea of Satan as a deluder to lead people away and lead them astray, etc. The fallen angels and their magical arts and so on. So here is an idea of this. Now, this whole business of angelologies and demonologies develops in the 3rd, 2nd, 1st century, not only in the Hellenistic world and in Palestine, but in Persia and other kinds of places. Now, in the northwest is the vision of the tree of life. The archangel Michael answered, "This high mountain which you've seen, whose summit is like the throne of God, is the throne of God. It is where the great, holy, great one, the Lord of glory, the eternal King, will sit when he comes to visit the earth with goodness. As for this fragrant tree, no mortal is permitted to touch it till the great judgment, when God's justice redresses all and brings everything to its ultimate consummation. The tree shall then be given to the good and holy. Its food shall be food for the elect." And here the word elect means self-elected, the ones who choose the right way. It doesn't mean the ones who are predestined to this. It means the ones who make the right choices. "Its food shall be food for the elect. It shall be transplanted to the holy temple of the Lord, the eternal King." Now, you can see already the elements of the kind of apocalypse that we have in the Apocalypse of John in the New Testament, where you will find whole verses taken directly from Isaiah and Isaiah's vision of the new heaven and the new earth, etc. But it's much more expanded into the new Jerusalem and the new temple coming down upon the earth and all this sort of thing. Now here we have the vision of the coming of what is called the Son of Man. You have to understand that the Son of Man is a term that means, and I want to translate this for you very carefully. The word Son means Scion, S-C-I-O-N, the offspring. That's what it means. If someone is called a son of God, it means he's godly, he's saintly. If someone is a son of evil, he's an evil person. He is doing that. But that doesn't mean he's there forever. Jesus looks at Peter, and when Peter says, after Jesus says, "I have to go to Jerusalem and suffer," he turns around and says, "Get thee behind me, Satan." That means Peter is a son of Satan. And then Peter immediately afterwards says something else that shows great insight, and he says, "Only the Spirit of God could have told you that." You know, Peter shifts from being a son of Satan to a son of God just that quick. And that's how it is with people and behavior. But the idea of a son of, in Hebrew idiom, means you're choosing at that moment to attach yourself to such a thing, and you can do it in the long term. Well, the Son of Man means the offspring of Adam, the offspring of humanity. And the Son of Man is a collective term. It's not an individual. It's not really the idea of a single Messiah. It's the idea of a new humanity, a new period, a new kind of humanity. It's actually not that inconsistent with some of the ideas you find in the secret doctrine of the root races and things like that. And the coming of the Son of Man, one like unto a Son of Man, someone in human form, goes up into heaven and becomes an archetype. And God empowers him. In the book of Daniel, previous to this, he's describing all these beasts that rule on the earth, and they have one horn and 10 horns and different kinds of things. But finally, one who's not like a beast, but is like a human, one who is in human form, comes forth, and God empowers that one to rule in righteousness and justice forever. That is, for the olam, which means the age, the eon, because there's no such thing as forever. There's just different seasons and ages that come in apocalyptic. Now, in this kind of literature, prophecy, which in the past was dealing with the Word of God, has started to deal with the future, the coming future, the secrets of the future, where humanity goes, where mankind goes. And the secrets that are revealed are that something very transforming is happening to mankind. Now, in the Greek mystery cults and mystery religions, and in Egyptian religion, the only person who had an afterlife in ancient Egypt originally was the pharaoh, and he did it on behalf of everyone. And then pretty soon it was the pharaoh's relatives, and they got little tombs and got to go through the Book of the Dead rituals and things. And then eventually it was democratized to everyone in the mystery cults. That is, everyone who led a good life and an ethical life and would go through the discipline. And if they did that, then they would become qualified and they would be able to ascend after death and retain full consciousness and not have to just go into Sheol or Devachan, as some people would say, and then be reincarnated again on the earth. So these ideas were coming of the this was called among the Greeks the idea of apotheosis, being transformed from a human into a god. And already there were ideas that if any really outstanding person appeared in life, that was not a regular human being. That person was a demigod, a semigod, a demigod. Even at this time, it was said that great people, great athletes, great warriors, etc., were half human, half divine. They were the result of intercourse between humans and gods in the Greek tradition. Socrates, Plato, not long after his death, within 20 years, the story is being told that he was not a normal, ordinary human being, that his mother had been visited by Zeus in the form of a serpent at the temple of Zeus and had sacred intercourse and conceived him, etc. This idea of sacred children being born that were conceived between gods and men was a very Greek idea. Among the Hebrews, it was an idea that was odious. The idea of intercourse between gods and humans produced these terrible offspring, the giants. And you'll find in the Greek myths the story of Tartarus and so on about the intercourse between that produced the race of demigods and so on. But another idea was happening, and before I read a little more from Enoch, I want to read you from the story of Noah. Now, part of this you'll find in your other Bible, but I'm going to read you from Charles. Charles contains so much more, the Assumption of Moses and the ascents of all kinds of different saints and things like this, and the Gospel of Adam and Eve and all kinds of other things you don't have in here. You have just a very small snippet collection of this literature in your other Bible. Anyway, this is a fragment from the Book of Noah. And this is a little more complete fragment than what you have in yours. It's about Lamech, who is the father of Noah, and the conception of this child, Noah, who is not an ordinary child. He's to be the savior of the world. Noah is the savior of the world in his day. And after some days, my son Methuselah took a wife for his son Lamech, and she became pregnant by him. This is Enoch speaking, and bore a son, and his body was white as snow and red as the blooming of a rose, and the head of his hair and his long locks were white as wool, and his eyes beautiful. And when he opened his eyes, he lighted up the whole house like the sun, and the whole house was very bright. And thereupon he arose in the hands of the midwife, opened his mouth, and conversed with the Lord of Righteousness. And his father Lamech was afraid of him, and fled, and came to his father Methuselah. And he said to him, I have begotten a strange son, diverse from an unlike man, and resembling the sons of God in heaven. And his nature is different, and he is not like us, and his eyes are as the rays of the sun, and his countenance is glorious. And it seems to me that he is not sprung from me, but from the angels, and I fear that in his days a wonder may be wrought on the earth. And now, my father, I am here to petition thee and implore thee that thou mayest go to Enoch, our father, and learn from him the truth, for his dwelling place is amongst the angels, etc., etc. So the idea of the birth of a divine child that comes through a human mother and a divine father is not only the idea in among the Jews of the birth of awful offspring like the giants because of the fallen angels and human beings, but also the birth of a Messiah-like being because of divine things and so on. Now, he goes to Enoch and asks him about this. And Enoch answered and said to him, The Lord will do a new thing on the earth. And this I have already seen in a vision, and make known to thee that in the generation of thy father, Jared, some of the angels of heaven transgressed the word of the Lord, and behold, they commit sin and transgress the law, and have united themselves with women, and commit sin with them, and have married some of them, and have begot children by them. And they shall produce on the earth giants, not according to the spirit, but according to the flesh. And there shall be a great punishment on the earth, and the earth shall be cleansed from all impurity. This is the story of the flood, the Noachic flood. Yea, there shall come a great destruction over the whole earth, and there shall be a deluge and a great destruction for 1 year. And this son who has been born unto you shall be left on the earth, and his three children shall be saved with him. When all mankind that are on the earth shall die, he and his son shall be saved. And now make known to thy son Lamech that who has been born, that he who has been born is in truth his son, and call his name Noah. For he shall be left to you, and he and his son shall be saved from the destruction which shall come upon the earth. And in your selection in the other Bible also, there's this strong affirmation, no, this is not a child that has been conceived of the evil intercourse between fallen angels and human beings, but rather is a true human being conceived from you, who is set by God with a great divine mission, and that is why he is so unlike others. Now, the Enoch cycle of literature continues from 1st Enoch to 2nd Enoch, the Apocalypse or Secrets of Enoch, on into the Christian era. I'll read you some bits from your other Bible. This is the book of the Secrets of Enoch, 2nd Enoch, page 495 and following. In this book, Enoch is taken into the heavens and shown what they are. Now, this book is fairly close to the time of St. Paul, who talks about being taken up into the third heaven. Here is a description of the third heaven that St. Paul was taken up into. It's called, Of the Assumption of Enoch to the Third Heaven. This is on page 496. And those men led me up to the third heaven and placed me there. And I looked downward and saw the produce of these places like no other goodness. And I saw all the sweet flowering trees and beheld their fruits, which were sweet smelling, and all the foods borne by them bubbling with fragrance. By the way, the heavens are aspects very often of the original Pardes, the Garden of Eden, from which human beings were excluded. And sometimes it's said that it is in the third heaven. And in the midst of the trees is the tree of life, that place where the Lord rests when he goes up into paradise. And this tree of life was also, by allegory, compared to the cross upon which Jesus died. And this human eyes can only see an evil, ugly cross, but in divine eyes it's a beautiful and divine thing. And this tree is of ineffable goodness and fragrance, and adorned more than any existing thing. And on all sides its form is gold and vermilion and firelike. It covers all and has produce from all fruits. Its root is in the garden at the earth's end, and paradise is between corruptibility and incorruptibility, that is, mortality and immortality. Two springs come out which send forth honey and milk, and their springs send forth oil and wine, and they separate into four parts and go round quietly and go down into the paradise of Eden between corruptibility and incorruptibility. And then they go forth along the earth which revolves like the elements. And there is no unfruitful tree, and every place is blessed. And there are 300 bright angels who keep the garden, and with sweet singing and never silent voices serve the Lord throughout all days and hours. So this gives you a little more insight into what it was that St. Paul was talking about when he was taken up into this place where unutterable things were told him. Returning now to the original book of Enoch, where Enoch has been told to take a message to the fallen angels, he's also shown other kinds of revelations. And there I saw the fountain of goodness. And this place where he sees them is in this place where the tree of life is and where the Ancient of Days sits on his throne. And I saw the fountain of goodness, which was inexhaustible, and round it were many fountains of wisdom, and all the thirsty drank from them, and were filled with wisdom, and they lived with the good and the holy and the elect. And at that hour, the Son of Man, and we should translate that as the offspring of humanity, the new humanity, was named before the Lord of Spirits, and his name was the Head of Days. Yes, before the sun and the signs were created, before the stars of heaven were made, his name was named before the Lord of Spirits. He will be a staff to the good, to stay themselves and not fall, and he will be the light of the Gentiles, and the hope of those who are troubled of heart. All those who live on earth will fall down and worship him, and will praise and bless and celebrate the Lord of Spirits with song. And so he has been chosen and hidden before God, before the creation of the world and for eternity. And the wisdom of the Lord of Spirits has revealed him to the holy and the good, for he preserved the good. And there is a good footnote on this by this man who is not really a biblical scholar. He says, Son of Man, the Messiah, the designation Son of Man frequently found in the pseudepigrapha in 1 Enoch, 4th Ezra, and the Psalms of Solomon is one of the many connections between intertestamental literature and the New Testament thought and language. Well, actually, there is a Son of Man school that goes back to Babylon and back to the Danielic school of Revelation. And that is really where the terminology is used by Jesus and his disciples comes. The Messiah, meaning the Anointed One, that's correct, Mashiach, in Hebrew and Greek is Christos, and that's where we get the word Christ, in English, Christ. The Greek word Christos is the Hebrew and Aramaic word Mashiach, which means the Anointed One, the one who has been chosen by God, or the one who has been commissioned or given the mission by God, and that's what anointing means. When you were anointed a king or anointed a prophet, it's your hands were laid upon your head, and that, in fact, is an ancient thing. When hands are laid upon the head, one is anointed with a mission, and that's how the apostles were anointed. But the laying upon of hands upon people for healing was a rather late development. Jesus Christ is a Greek version from Hebrew, which is more properly translated into English as Joshua the Messiah. That's right. The name Jesus, Yeshua, is the same name, exact name, as Joshua, the successor of Moses, Joshua the son of Nun. He says, Son of Man also appears in the Old Testament. This passage is derived from Daniel 7.8. Well, that, in fact, is the derivation point for this whole mystery school. And then the light of the Gentiles, he gives you a footnote on that, which is also very good. In Isaiah 56:3-8, Isaiah welcomes the Gentiles to convert and love God. No one, neither outcast nor eunuch, will be excluded when God brings the Gentiles into the covenant to his holy mountain. Conversion is emphasized in the pseudepigrapha and is another link to New Testament emphasis of Jewish thought and so on. Well, this is quite true. The prophetic schools that became universalistic and developed to the point where it was no longer a kind of an ingrown religion, where a Zionistic religion where the Jews are the only true people and the only people of God, but rather the Jews had a mission to all humanity to bring a light. The Jew as the suffering servant of God is portrayed in the 52nd chapter of Isaiah and so on, is referred to, and it forms the basis for what we call the passion narrative of Jesus, where his garments are parted and where he says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Jesus doesn't say that. That's what the psalm says, and Jesus is referring to the psalm, which is saying, is the way of the writer of the New Testament saying, look, this is the suffering servant of God, because that's what is said in the psalm that relates to this this vision of Isaiah of the suffering servant of God. So originally the suffering servant of God is understood collectively as the Jewish people who have the mission to bring the light of God to the Gentiles. And then it's personified as a Messiah, and then personified even farther down finally as Jesus by the Christians when they transmute the idea of Jesus and Christ into the Greek ideas of gods and of a God coming to earth and so on. So this is the derivation and origination of this idea. From this time, we have also the great deal of intercourse between the Jews and the Gentiles. There has been from earliest times, but now there is a great deal of this, because so many Jews are in the diaspora and they are Greek-speaking, and the Jewish scriptures are translated into Greek, into the Septuagint. And the religious conventions of Judaism, which were very simple and very ethnic and very much in imitation of other Near Eastern cultures, the Edomites and the Assyrians and the Egyptians. And you have to understand that the Jewish Old Testament is a continuation of Egyptian religion and of Edomite religion and of the religion of the ancient Near East. Now, with the contacts that are made in Hellenistic or Hellenic culture with the Greeks and other kinds of traditions, Jewish religion is opened up to other kinds of contacts. And that is why we have a lot of very important religious ideas expressed in Greek. One of the ones I want to talk about is the Sibylline oracles, the oracles delivered by a wise woman, by the Jewish version of the Sibylline. And this is very much in the tradition of the Greek oracles, but now it is not a man prophet who delivers, but a woman prophet. And the revelations of the female prophets, the prophetess in Israel and Hebrew are very different, and they are very much important to understanding the origins of Christianity, because Christianity did have a great deal of Hellenic influence within Judaism. The conflict between the Hebraists and the Hellenists in the early church among the early Jewish Messianic Jews was illustrated this problem. Let's turn over the tape now.